Station number 15433.
Peter McAleish, side 11. So, you had this big attack.
Yeah, so we then got up early the next morning and we went to the hangar and the parachutes were all laid out. And I have never in my life seen such a sense of purpose, you know. Everybody was helping each other, you know. And, I mean, we were sort of totally covered in equipment and kit, you know. And it was a, you know, we weren't carrying rucksacks. You know, all you had was fighting order, you know. And there was stuff hanging off all over us and opening up the parachutes. Everybody helped each other. And they marched us out to the aircraft. And we went up to a place called Lake Alexander, which is up in the Inyanga area. And the six DACs started flying around there. And flying around at the same time was 64 helicopters, right? And above that was, there was 16 hunters, then 16 vampires, 16 hunters, and then 16 of those Canberras. And then the choppers took off first, followed by the DACs, you know. And they said that the first strike would begin at 15 minutes to 8 that morning, airstrike, and the first paratroops would go over the door of the aircraft at 13 minutes to. And we stood, you know, we all took off, and the whole lot came over the target at the same time. I mean, I was number one in the starboard stick. I was looking out the door, and I could see the hunter putting in an airstrike, you know, really laying in. And the K-cars were really doing the business on the place, you know, getting into their circuits.
K-cars are?
Cannon cars, you know, carrying 20mm right. cannons. So you got a G car, which is a gun quad 30 calibers, and you get the
what helicopters were they?
Alouettes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and they were doing the business and all that. And then the paratroops started jumping, and I looked at my watch, and I went over that. I went over that step at exactly time. I see. I landed on the ground, and I was sort of hooked up on a tree. And a guy opened fire on me, and they dropped us about 400 feet, and buff, buff, you know, straight onto the ground. And a guy called Steve Kluzniak landed right next to me. I mean, that's how close we were, you know. Yeah. We never had time to spread out.
Right, and somebody opened fire.
Somebody opened fire on me, and I couldn't cape well. My feet were just touching the ground. And
yes.
So I bit faintly cape-welled. I ran in behind an anthill, and the fire was chasing me all around the anthill. So Kluzniak sort of pinned him into one side of the tree. I eventually got my equipment off. And then I just heard click, and the guy said, he said to me, he says, you know, he put his hand out like that, you know, and I says, come here. And the first thing I said, he never gave me a chance. So I just shot him.
Mm.
So we lay there. And
so who was that, a Frelimo or?
No, he was a Zanla, Zanla okay. terrorist. The operation was against Zanla.
Right.
The code name for it was Zulu 1.
Okay.
So we lay there, and all morning we were just catching. The key cars were sweeping the people out towards us, can you see? And we were a sort of stop group. And what happened, the paratroops were like that. And then the helicopters came in, and 32 helicopters dropped guys that way. They were totally surrounded.
Right.
So they started flushing us out.
So the helicopters filled in the flanks, basically.
Yeah. So we, you know, we were shooting at people all morning. And at 12 o'clock, about quarter to 12, they say, stand up. Start sweeping, and the game was on. And I've never seen killing like that in my life. You know, I mean, the time we stopped sweeping, I'd killed 13 terrors. You know, I mean, it was just firefights all the way up there.
Mm.
And I mean, there was women and everything. You know, women terrorists. In fact, there was one of the guys was killed, a guy called Franz Nell. Anyway, we swept into the centre of the camp, and we hit the complex, where they do the, you know, the sort of headquarter complex, and they've got a different name from it. We swept in there. The information we picked up was phenomenal.
So was it a sort of a large hutted camp or barracks?
It was
or?
4 kilometres wide, 7 kilometres long, with 5,000 people in it.
And you went through that?
We went in top of 5,000 people. There was anti-aircraft guns, everything firing at us when we went in. Lucky enough, they weren't highly trained people.
Mm.
Anyway, we got into this headquarters area, and one of the guys had left his RPG-7 rockets next to a building, and there was some tracer came across. The building caught fire. He couldn't get the rockets. The next thing was rockets sort of flying all over the place. But we grabbed as much information as we could out, you know, and it was a lot of big stuff.
Mm. Anyway, were you given objectives to get information or prisoners? Or
prisoners and information.
Yeah.
And to actually destroy the enemy in the base.
Yes, sure.
We were having contacts all afternoon. We took our area, and once we'd established, when the sweeps come in tight, you know, as you come in tighter, you're going to get problems because you can be shooting at your own guys.
Yeah. The infantry closes in on the target. Yeah.
So what we did then is, all afternoon we were on about having contacts all over the place. You know, we hit another group of 80, and you know.
What were you armed with at that time?
I was carrying an RPD, an RPK, a heavy barreled. AK,
a little bipod.
Yeah. So, and the great thing was I could use as much ammunition as I was because I was replenishing my ammunition from them. Mm-hmm. We were sort of fighting all afternoon, and at night time we went in the ambush position, and the helicopters all pulled away, so they all come in, they're going, comrade, comrade, and we're running, there's ambushes going all night, contacts going all night. So, you know, we got up the next morning, and the next thing is the whole same thing started again.
They're counterattacking.
No, they were walking back in to try and... They didn't know where they were. So, you know, anyway, we had a body count of about 680 out of that group. You know, that's all...
How did they do the body count? They piled them all in this one...
No, we counted them along the same age as you get. I get seven.
Right.
You know, there were 680 for the... And, you know, we didn't know how many was wounded.
Mm.
But, you know, we got the figures later on. We killed, it was 600, nearly 700 killed, 2,000 wounded. Mm. Anyway, we come back out. That afternoon, we come back out and we get flown back to Salisbury. So we're all get the kit and we're walking out. Oh, yeah.
So how they
helicopter? The extractors.
Yeah.
The extractors by helicopter, right? Flew us to an airstrip. We picked up Dakotas.
The airstrip was within Mozambique, was
it? No, the airstrip was inside Rhodesia.
All right, okay.
So they ferried us over the Rhodesian border, picked us, I think it was Buffalo Range or something, dropped us there, and we took off, flew into to Salisbury. We got off at Salisbury and we're giving it, get home, a couple of beers, you know, go down the pub. I says, right, chaps, back in the cage. So we sat there, I says, I wonder what's going on now. They had a meal for us, you know. So we all went away and get showered and shaved. We come out on the Thursday. We jumped in a Wednesday, come out on a Thursday evening.
Mm.
I says, right, you're going to another operation, Operation Zulu 2. Start kitting up. So we went through with the battle procedure, you know.
Mm.
Receive a warning order, give a warning order. So we started kitting up again. Ammunition, grenades, you know, water bottles. And I said, okay. We went back in the Saturday morning, same thing, 7:45 objective, and we jumped into another place called Tembe. So we hit that place. This was on the Saturday morning, first thing. We flew over Lake Cabora Bassa. I mean, the planes were that low, you can actually see the water being disturbed from the propellers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just whipped up to 1,000 feet and flew in and attacked this camp called Tembe.
And what sort of objective was that?
It was another enemy base.
How many big people? And
the figures we got were 3,500, but we when we got there was only about 1,500. So we
did they have a big model as well and all the rest of it?
Oh yeah, same type of briefing, the whole lot. We went in.
How many were the Rhodesian casualties?
On the first part of it, we had 1 killed, 9 wounded.
Mm. Out of who? How many landed?
150.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now remember about thing later on. I'll tell you something else that happened about the casualties. So we then jumped in, and the battle started, and we cleared up. We got about 30. The group I was with, and you know, and one of the pilots came back. And he says, there's a massive group of them further up. And this Bob McKenzie, who was a troop officer, said, right, guys, flagged the helicopters down off his own bag, back. The ferry is up and we cleaned up this other place, you know.
Were they in? How were they disposed? I mean, were they in a camp or?
They were in a big camp. There were a series of. See, what you had was a series of camps.
Right.
Can you see that? Adjoined by a road.
Right.
And so we really started doing the business there.
What was your procedure for this impromptu attack?
Oh, Bob just says, get on the ground, we'll sort it out when we get there. We get out straight into a sweep line and started sweeping. So we were, you know, we were doing.
And they got no prepared defences?
No, nothing. Because they'd all been so safe there.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, there was weapons.
Yeah.
Mortars, machine guns and anti-aircraft guns, but there wasn't. The trench systems were fairly weak, you know. Mm. They were token gestures of,
right.
of defence.
Were you able to capture much kit there?
Oh, yeah.
Tons.
In actual fact, we had to destroy an awful lot. We couldn't bring it back. There
right.
was that much.
Right.
You're
saying, so how many casualties were, how many troops were committed and how many casualties were incurred?
None killed in that one. But, you know, when the sort of debris cleared between the two camps,
mm.
it was 1,200 killed and 2,000 wounded. And we lost one guy, I think it was either 9 or 11 wounded.
What tale were you going to say you to remind you to tell yourself?
I got back from the operation and my wife was a nurse. I'd married I'd been living with a girl in Rhodesia.
I see.
Aye, and she said to me, how did it go? And unbeknown to us, the nurses were all briefed as well. Can you see that? They, you know, like the boys are on a big one.
Yeah.
You know, get ready.
By, yeah.
And they had four wards laid out for the wounded. You know, and I said, you know, I mean, guys were talking about a camp too far. Can you see that? We've just overdone it this time.
Yeah.
We came back, as I say, we came back in, and we flew. And what happened in order to get to the Rhodesians were good at this. In order to get the distance to get to this camp with the helicopters. The Rhodesians had dropped parachute supplies onto the top of a mountain called a train,
mm-hmm.
which was a big plateau in the shape of a train. Lobodel something, it means the iron horse. So what happened is a big heavy aircraft would get in, like a DC-9 or something, drop all the petrol by parachute. The paratroops would drop on top of it, organise it so the helicopters would come in, run out of fuel, refuel on top of this mountain so as they could get the extra distance to get to the target.
Mm.
We called them admin bases.
Mm.
Anyway, pulled into that on the way back.
Which was very advanced. I mean, the Russians talked about it at the same later.
Yeah.
You know, the only first time we've really used that was in the Gulf War.
Yeah.
But that's back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how deep into Mozambique was this one?
In actual fact, we'd crossed 200 miles in.
Really?
Aye. And we were really up, we were nearly in Zambia. It was right, you know, right in the northern Mozambique, the other side of Lake Cabarabassa.
Okay.
We came in from that.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, you'd actually married, you'd been divorced in the UK.
No, I met another woman out there.
All right, but you were married her?
I married her later on.
All right, okay. I was going to say, did you have permission to live off base, or you were on base, or how did it work?
No, you just in Rhodesia, in the army, if you had a flat, you didn't need to come into barracks. That's the way it was.
Right.
If there was, you know.
Were you making much money at that time?
No, it was it was a pittance, you know.
Right.
And when I joined the army,
but you could, what?
Oh, you could live fairly well in it, but you know, you weren't well off.
No.
What
sort of contact did you have with the civil population?
I never had much, but one day
a
chap came to me and brought a parcel to me, and he says, you've been adopted. And the Rhodesians used to adopt foreigners, you know, and you get a parcel with, you know, like oatmeal biscuits, and they'd always put a balaclava in for you, you know, knit balaclavas and gloves. And I had to go and, when you were on leave, you're expected to go and see these old people, or people who'd adopted you. And you know, and let them know how the war was going and let them know what you were doing. So I went, and there was an old group of old ladies, and, you know, I had to tell them, you know, about the regiment and, you know, what we were doing. And you got the normal carry on when you left. Don't forget to get one for me, you know. And there was a marvellous thing there. I was really moved by it. I went to a place called Sonoy, and we were on the way back from somewhere, and I went into this, what they call troopy canteens. And I walked in, the woman says, what do you want? I says, I'll have a hamburger and a cup of tea, please. I says, how much do you owe you? She says, son, you don't owe us nothing. That's our way of saying thank you to you. And you know, I mean, it's even made me feel a bit emotional now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't believe it. You know, there was no, it wasn't like the Nafi tried to exploit the situation. You know, it was, there was one woman at Sonoya. She made thousands of jars of chutney. They called her the Chutney Queen, you know, for the soldiers in the bush, you know. And it was always, you get into there and it was, the toilets in them were always the graffiti on it, you know, of the units all slagging each other down, you know, you know, references made to the Salou Scouts and the SAS, you know. And as I say, it was, we had that, and like I met Jane, you know, she was a civilian, but generally speaking, everybody was mobilised there, so you always met someone, you know.
How did you get on with the local, the Rhodesian population, by definition, white population?
To be honest with you, I found them a wee bit arrogant. The, you know, they were always on, you know, they were always on about Britain, the Brits, this and the Brits, and you know, you're sitting there as a Brit, and what can you say? You know, what they're actually saying is true, Britain sold us down the river.
Mm.
And from their point of view, Britain sold them down the river. I mean, from our point of view, politically, they were it was no longer viable to keep the thing running. Mm. So, and the other thing was, they used to get an awful lot of abuse, you know. They had their girlfriends and local girlfriends, and so there was a pub there called the Elizabeth there, where, you know, coloured ladies used to hang about. Now, you know, in Africa, you get a sort of caste system. You know, you got a white, a coloured, and a black.
Mm.
Or a white, a coloured, an Asian, and a black. Can you see that? So coloured girls are, you know, they're sort of what we call a half caste.
Mm.
So, you know, the guys that, you know, that used to go to the coloured dance hall, which was out of bounds, and they were always getting rounded up, you know. And the Rhodesians held that in contempt. But, you know, by the same token, they weren't away from their wives and kids. Can you see that?
Yeah.
It was, you know, they went away from their sweethearts.
Yeah.
So I can understand it from my side.
Yeah.
And there was an arrogance with them. The funny thing was, the arrogance lay not with the combat soldiers. It lay with the people who were on the fringe of it, you know.
Yeah. What was the atmosphere there, though? And they knew they were going to have to pack it in the end.
No, they didn't.
Did they not?
No, they were... I mean, up until I seen the writing on the wall about 78, end of 78. You know, they were on about, we'll become white terrorists, we'll plough salt into the ground, we'll do this and we'll do that. And the fact is politically, the country was in its death throes. Can you see that?
Economically. But also the casualty rates were just...
No, what happened then was, you know, we started taking casualties. You know, the fact is if we didn't kill 35 of them for every one that went down, you know, we were losing. Now, this was okay with the heavy combat troops, your SAS, your RLI. You know, that was a case, but when it came to units like Guard Force...
Guard Force was what?
Guard Force was... they guarded the bridges, the installations and whatnot. And
who was in that?
That was black troops led by whites who had done a form. The blacks had done a little bit of training.
Right.
You had internal affairs troops who manned the keeps and whatnot. And they were fairly, you know, they weren't high caliber troops.
Yeah.
So you know, when it got to those amount of troops, which was the bulk of the army, the casualty we weren't killing 35 for everyone. You know.
How did you find their attitude with the Africans compared with anybody else's attitude, the South Africans?
The Rhodesian, and I've got to be fair on them here, they felt a sense of duty towards the African.
Mm.
You know, and like, you got the odd one that was a bit racist, but generally speaking, they looked after the Africans. Like, you know, if you took on an African family, you were responsible for the medical bills, you were responsible for the school bills for the kid, you were responsible for the clothing and uniforms and books for the kids. And in fairness to most Rhodesians, they measured up to that.
Right.
But, you know, it was also suitable to them. Then you can go to the other side where a farmer would have a Rhodesian staff, black Rhodesians working for him, and he paid them so much a month. And he had a shop owned by him where they had to spend the money.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that side of it wasn't nice. But that is the way the economy of the country ticked over. So consequently, when the Nationalists get in later on, everything just went haywire.
How did you find your colleagues that you're fighting with alongside?
No, there was never any racial. We just looked upon them as the enemy, you know. And
other blokes in your unit.
Aye.
You're a foreigner. How did you get on with them?
In the SAS, it was okay.
Mm. How many other foreigners were in the SAS?
In the A squadron, the majority of the foreigners were in the A troop, which later became A squadron.
All right.
They were all in there. At one stage, 33, and the lowest ever was, I think, was about 27.
Out of?
Well, of the regulars in the squadron, there was only about 40 regulars in the squadron.
So you're talking about one third at least, or almost 40%?
No, 75% in my squadron.
Were foreigners?
Were foreigner.
All right.
But the other squadron was nearly totally Rhodesian.
Right. And you got on with these...
Oh, we got on all right with them. You know, they...
Yeah. Were you having any more dust-ups at this stage?
I had one in training, and I get 28 days in nick for it.
Oh, really?
An American Marine, an ex-American Marine, came down to help out with training. And every Sunday to watch a military movie, and we're sitting there this Sunday, and, you know, we're watching the movie Waterloo, and the next thing, whoop, the camera gets switched off. You can hear zzz, you know that sound,
the reel running down.
So this guy comes up and stands up in front and says, "For those of you who don't know me, I'm Sergeant Langley. I've been watching you guys for the past few weeks, and I'm not impressed." I think he may have been drinking. And he says, "You know, I just want you to know that I'll be coming to help out with your training tomorrow, and I'm not impressed one bit." Then he went, "I've got the greatest pain tolerance in the world. I can't feel your pain one bit." So these kids are all flapping. So we had Batman in the Rhodesian Army, but there was no Batman over the weekend. So all the stuff you've used on Saturday, you had to wash it yourself and get it ready. So for some
reason... They were blacks.
We had black Africans to do it.
Sure.
So he comes down, and for some unknown reason, we were training on the Sunday. And I got the guys to iron all their kit. And I came out, and this maniac comes down, and he was a maniac. And he was there for one reason, was to terrorise us. Mm. And he took this upon himself. Now, I never found out till later. So, unbeknown to me...
He was unofficial?
Yeah, he just came down, "I'll give a handout in training wing." Can you see that? Yeah. Went and seen the boss, "I've got nothing to do, can I come down and help you out?" And he just went... And he told people, he said, "I'm going to put him in nick." You know, I didn't even know the man. He says, "I'll get these recruits, I'll show them where way they're going. I'll show them..." You know, on that. I didn't know. And what I noticed was none of the rear rank instructors were the corporals.
Yeah.
So he then comes down, and so we're marching up, and he's threatening everybody, stopping us every couple of paces, you know, harassing people. And then he stops, halts us, and he comes up to me, he says, "Boy, you weren't a calling out at the time." I says, "Sergeant, I was." He says, "Boy," I says, "you weren't a calling out at the time." I says, "Sergeant, I was." He says, "I says you weren't." I says, "I was." And I swore him. He says, "Boy, put yourself in jail." And he grabbed my rifle. And I could see a smirk in his face. And I walked off to put myself in jail. And he says, "I says, double, boy." You know, the real American Marine type stuff. And I went, "Well, if I'm going to go in nick, I may as well make it for something." So I just went back and battered him. And I had a black beret on, and I chased him into the MT.
He ran after him.
I ran
and
after
he
him.
Ran.
And he ran. And he was trying to butt stroke me the rifle, and I polished him off in the MT. And I went down to training wing. And the guy in charge of training wing, he Captain Johnson, he bust out laughing at me. Then he says, "I'm sorry, Michael." He says, "I can't charge you." I says, "Why is that?" He says, "Because I'm going to let you away." He says, "I'll let you go." He says, "If ever a man needed a hiding, it was him." You know, so I says, you know, he said, "But you know, you're going to have to go to jail, son. You know, and I don't want nothing to do with you. As far as I'm concerned, you've done the right thing." So they whipped me into the CEO, and I got 28 days in jail for it. And I went to Bull Whale, you know.
Yeah.
I say it was total insanity.
The other thing, bumping all these people off, I mean, didn't it have an effect on you? Or?
No, it didn't, because it was heavy duty soldiering. Plus the fact they were trying to kill me. Mm. I think there was once when a guy just sprung up in front of me, and I just came up instinctively, and he was taken off, and he was probably about 2-3 yards in front of me, and I just went, and I pulled the trigger on my weapon, and I got him in the back of the head. Mm. And somehow the bullet came up and it just lifted part of his brain onto my shirt. And, I said I did that without thinking. I never even, there was no thought in it. There was no thinking it through. It was instinctive. And I could smell the sweet smell of them all afternoon. And it was the first time I ever questioned it.
Really?
Aye.
Yeah.
And, as I say... I said to myself, has anything actually been solved by this? When I told you we did that jump at Chamoyo, I mean, I destroyed $4 million worth of transport. Just putting explosive charges, blowing the engine blocks, setting them on fire, lighting the petrol tanks. And when we took off there and the whole place was just blazing. And I went, what has actually been solved? If this money was used here in another way, could it not help towards the problem?
Mm.
But, there was the destruction that was there. It was phenomenal.
Mm. What about, shooting these, you're saying women terrorists, some of these must have been very unprepared when,
Oh, this is what hurts me, especially the African nationalists. They get all the women in there and they're going, Pambarini, Chinimaranga, and all this Chinese-type training. Everybody's shouting slogans and everybody's having a good sing-song and we're going to free our country. And all of a sudden, 150 professional soldiers come sailing down out of the sky and they're expected to perform.
Mm.
And they can't. Mm. The professional soldiers are there to do a job, and they have put themselves in a position where the professional soldiers are going to do the job on them. And the thing is with the women, the one guy we had killed at Chamoyo was killed by a woman.
Mm.
And the way you got to look at it in a terrorist war, if a woman is freeing a man, and by looking after the bosses and running certain things. Surely she not a terrorist as well. Mm. That is the motivation behind it.
What about people like the Salu Scouts? Did you have much to do with them? Or what were your views on the other units that were involved?
I think the Salu Scout, the recce wing of the Salu Scout was probably one of the most professional I've seen. I mean, those guys had to use army terminology, they had balls,
Right. They were said that they were very reckless. The Sulu Scouts
were
they shot prisoners, they almost bloodlust.
No,
shot people. Went to the hospital on a similar operation to the one you're talking about.
Yeah.
Went to the hospital and shot all the wounded terrorists. All right, they're terrorists. But
I don't know where you got that from, but my experience with the Scouts was merely. And reconnaissance, and they always reconnoitred the targets and called us in on them. There was times when the Salu Scouts did go and do raids,
yes.
But most of they did one at Pungwe. I think they got involved in the second Chamoyo raid. But other than that, the Salu Scouts were mainly involved with reconnaissance.
Right. The one I had read about was the one where they went vehicle-borne deep into Angola.
That was the Pungwe raid.
Right.
And they went into Mozambique.
Yes.
And what happened is they went in they went in dressed up as Frelimo, and they went into the camp and the people all came charging towards them, and it was a camp and the shooting started from there.
Mm.
By the time they were on the way, then the Salu Scouts started shooting. They didn't realise it. They didn't know it was Scouts. They thought it was Frelimo coming after a Frelimo column.
Yeah. What did you think of the
Rhodesian infantry?
Yeah.
They were extremely good at fire force, what you call fire force, helicopter-borne operations. And the other thing they were good is they were a unit that was actually press-ganged into parachuting. I mean, they never volunteered for it. They were just press-ganged. And peer pressure made them all jump.
Mm.
So the whole thing was to do with lack of helicopters. So, they drop the guys and get them on the ground, the helicopter would move them about. But the main thing is they could get the bulk of the guys over the target.
Right. The police and special branch and reserves, how did you?
The actual special branch, the old special branch, were highly skilled men.
Oh.
And what happened when the war started, the special branch expanded, and with the expansion, they lost an awful lot of quality.
Okay.
Now, I'm not saying it as a professional policeman. I'm saying it as an onlooker.
Right.
And I feel that certain things were lost, yeah.
Yeah. You're saying these sort of criticisms of the local, the white population.
Yeah.
I mean, were you put off to any extent that you were fighting with their hat badge, if you see what I mean, for these bunch of guys that keep...
No, I didn't, because I just loved the army.
Right.
And Rhodesia gave me the opportunity. You know, when I say I found an arrogance in them, you know, there was an arrogance.
Hmm.
But it was, you just said, that's the way they are.
Right. So that brings us up to roughly, what, 80, when Rhodesia stopped being Rhodesia and became Zimbabwe, and became Zimbabwe. So had you got any... were you able to get any promotion and that? Or?
I in the Rhodesian Army, I made sergeant.
Right.
I finished up working with the special branch there, I got to sergeant.
Right. And how did you? What duties were you doing with the special branch?
I was training pseudo gangs and working with them.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Well, what happened is, the Sulu Scouts had a special branch wing, and
yes.
I worked for that wing. So guys that never.